Jack Coughlin is a gunnery sergeant, or was a gunnery sergeant, in your United States Marine Corps. He has more confirmed kills than any other sniper on active duty in the U.S. military, and has written about his experiences, both in the military and at war, in a new book that is out with a great title, just simply called Shooter. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. What's the difference between a sniper and a sharpshooter?
A sharpshooter is not as trained as a sniper. He's just trained in marksmanship. A sniper is trained in the field craft of hiding, blending, and deceiving also.
Yeah, I had always thought that sniper was what we called the other guys, sharpshooters, but that's not the case. You are a sniper, and that's not an insult?
No, that's not an insult. That's actually an MOS, our military occupational skill, Marine Corps Scout Sniper.
And you served, how many years did you put in the Corps?
Almost 21.
Congratulations and thank you for your service. I say that to everybody who wears the uniform.
Thank you.
And certainly goes for you because you helped save lives. When you were serving and you were asked to go in and take care of a situation, do you have free rein or do you have to wait and somebody says, see that guy, get him?
We have 95% of the time open battlefield where it's targets of opportunity. As long as it's within the rules of engagement, we're free to fire. And then there's a restriction on, okay, we want to wait for this condition to be set and then go ahead and take the shot then.
I was reading your book this morning, and there's some great stories in there. And I'd like you to share with me and my listeners the story of the first guy you took out in Iraq. Actually, two guys you took out in Iraq in one building where your colleagues were taking fire.
It was the first day of the war. We were pulled up right outside of the Basra International Airport. We just went through the 51st Mechanized Infantry Division's headquarters. And I had been a little bit ahead of one of our units and got a call that they were taking a harassment fire. They knew the general direction, but they didn't know exactly where from. And instead of just lobbing off everything they had on them, they wanted me to come up and see if I could surgically take them out so we wouldn't kill innocent Iraqis. Went back to the position, started scoping out the area, saw a target in one of them down on the lower level in the bushes, took him out and caught a glimpse of movement above me, looked up, saw his buddy up there looking down. He went back and hid behind the wall. Waited, and sooner or later, you know, he got a little curious, and he poked his head out again, and we put him to sleep, too.
You say in the book, curiosity kills, and that was a perfect example there. You also write that a bush is a horrible place to hide. Explain that.
A bush is a good place to try to blend in, but it's not cover. Cover protects you from bullets and fragmentation. Concealment, that hides you. So he thought the bullet would stop it. Put the bushes, but that didn't work.
How far away was he?
He was about, that shot, I think, was about 700 yards.
Now, when you are lying, do you lie down? Do you sit? Do you stand? What's your preferred position?
My actual preferred position is a tight sitting position using support, with a rifle supported on an object.
A ledge or something
right,
would be perfect?
That's perfect because of my body stature. Normally, the prone position with support is the best position.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you'll shoot in any certain circumstances that combat dictates, but you always want to do it supported.
How many shots did it take to get those guys?
Two.
Two shots for two guys,
mm-hmm.
One each. Now, when you look through your scope, it's something I can't see 700 yards away. That's seven football fields. I probably couldn't see that with binoculars. Your scope gives you a view of how far away?
It's called a 10-power scope, so it magnifies 10 powers at 1,000 yards.
Mm-hmm.
So, we hold a 10-inch shot group at 1,000 yards, so if you have a 10-inch pie plate under ideal circumstances, each round would hit with that pie plate.
Wow.
We have a bigger spotting scope, which is 20 power, so your spotter can look. So, you know, the further away the target, the less detail you see, but you can still see the target and what it's doing, you know, the good outline and all that.
How far can you shoot?
We have two different weapon systems. With the M40A1, we can shoot up to 1,000 yards and a little further with ballistical come-ups. And also with the Sasser 50 cal sniper rifle, we can shoot up to 1,800 yards.
Wow. Holy cow.
22 to 24 with a ballistical come up.
I don't even know what that means, and I'm impressed. And you mentioned you have a spotter. Is that a guy who's with you, who's helping you figure out who's the target and where he is?
Yeah, your spotter is out there looking for targets on the battlefield with you. He's also helping you judge the wind and what the correct dope to put on the weapon.
Is he also a sniper? Do you take turns, or is he just a spotter?
Well, yeah, preferably you have both of you as school-trained, but not all the time is the spotter been through the school and graduated. But you do flip off. Even though he hasn't graduated, he's still qualified to be behind the gun.
Okay, now you mentioned something there about the wind and other conditions, which leads me to believe that science is a big part of the life of the sniper, because I think when most people think, oh, he's a sniper, that means he's really good with a gun, but that's not all there is to it, right?
Right. Academics is a strong, strong part of what we do. You have to know a lot of math skills. You have to be able to tell if I have a 5-mile wind from left to right at 1,000 yards, how far do I have to move? How far that will that move the round?
Mm-hmm.
Also, the mirage. If on a hot day, when you look down the street, you ever see the mirage, the heat wave?
Absolutely.
By looking in your scope, you can actually tell how fast the wind is there.
Wow.
And there's other tricks to the trade too, but it's a lot of math, a lot of terminal ballistics, so you're figuring out what the bullet drop compensation is going to be.
How does a guy growing up in the suburbs of Boston become the top-ranked Marine sniper? Were you a guy who liked guns as a kid?
Never touched a weapon until I went to recruit training. Luckily for me, the Marine Corps has an outstanding marksmanship training program. I didn't have any bad habits, therefore I took everything that they said to heart. I did it my own way of doing things. And,
wait, what do you mean by bad habits?
I've never fired before, so I wasn't comfortable doing anything on my own.
Oh, so whatever they trained is exactly all you learned.
I learned exactly how the ideal condition is. I learned exactly how they wanted me to learn without any prior knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I had good eyesight and good hand and eye coordination and progressed from there.
Wow. We got to come back and talk more about the book Shooter with the top-ranked Marine sniper in the United States Marine Corps, Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin, retired, right?
Just recently, yeah, last month.
Congratulations. Thanks again for your service. It's the Paul Harris Show, back in a moment on KMOX. Talking with retired Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin of the United States Marine Corps, the top-ranked Marine sniper. No official count on this, but we think the number of confirmed kills is over 60. Right? Are you sure of an actual number?
Oh, I know exactly how many.
You do?
I just don't say.
Don't. Okay. That's fine. Whatever number it is, I'm impressed by it. I've never pulled a trigger on a gun. I hope to go through my life never doing that. That's my own choice. I know lots of people like them. I don't particularly like them, but I'm fascinated by people who are really good with them, like you are. But during the break, we were talking about the science of it and the technology of it and all that sort of stuff. And here's something I've always been curious about. You pull that trigger, that bullet gets there in a hurry. It's probably less than a second before that guy's feeling that burning in his chest, if he's feeling anything. Can he hear the bullet? Is there such a thing as hearing a bullet?
No, unless it misses you, because that's the crack, the supersonic sound that you hear, boom, crack. If it mm-hmm. misses you, you'll hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that snap you hear over your head or to your left ear light. And they kind of depict it a little bit on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But that thing hits you, you'll hear a thud if you still got some sensations in your ear.
Where's the best place to hit somebody?
Ultimately, the best place to hit somebody is the medulla oblongata, which is that little pocket right here above your nose. It's an instant kill, but I mean that's a small target to hit. So
that's because it goes through the head and gets the back where the medulla oblongata is.
Exactly.
Right?
But yeah. The best place to hit is the mediast portion of the target available. That's the way we shoot.
The mediast portion.
Right. So if I have a quarter of your body there, I'm going to center it off at half. Center it halfway and shoot right for the middle. Mm-hmm. I want to take the biggest target I have.
Did you always shoot to kill?
Oh yes. Oh, yes, most definitely.
You never thought, I'm going to get this guy in the leg, take him out of action, and our guys can go in and grab him, and we'll have a POW?
Not unless that was our mission. If we were specifically looking to take down prisoners to interrogate them for some reason or whatever, but, mm-hmm. Getting a little Hollywood there.
I'm curious about it because I've never been there and you have.
I have shot somebody that has actually lived
mm-hmm.
twice.
Was that your mistake or you did it on purpose?
No, he was just running, and it's hard to hit people when they're running. I shot him twice, once through the left bicep and once through his shoulder, and mm-hmm. he went down out of sight, and the fight was going on, so I kept fighting other people, and when it ended up consolidating and the battle was over, we ended up capturing him, and I actually interviewed him through an interpreter.
Hmm. What was that like for you?
I was happy he was alive. He was no longer a threat to us, so, I did my job. He was out of the fight, and, he was just a young conscript, didn't want to be there, so, he was just doing what he was told.
Tell me if this is true. As I was reading your book this morning, this is how I felt about you. You liked doing what you did, but you didn't necessarily like killing people.
That's a pretty good estimate. I enjoy defending my country. I'm proud of what I've done in that aspect. I'm proud of being a Marine for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I like being the Marine. It was really good camaraderie and stuff, but I despise war and I take no solace and take no gratitude in anything I've done in war. But unfortunately it's a necessary evil.
Yeah. And you were so good at it that, you used the word surgical before. That's what you were called in to do. Are we using snipers differently in war now?
Not necessarily. Right now, we have the same type of warfare, static warfare, where it's going on, raids and things of that nature, which is we have awesome doctrine on. So they're being utilized in that way. I'm not going to discuss it. But, in mobile warfare, we had to come up with a few techniques during the march up to Baghdad because it's not a place for snipers to be employed that often. So we had to, come up with some new crazy ideas how to get up front.
Mm-hmm.
But we used them well. I mean, the government, it's military, understands what collateral damage is, and we create less collateral damage.
Right. What is the sniper strike team?
That was what we created over in Iraq because, like I said, ideally what we do is if we're going to do an attack, we go in beforehand, we'll set in a position, and we'll be able to give information to the battlefield commander on the way in and then support by fire once he gets in there. But when you don't know where you're going, you can't get ahead of them, and you're doing an assault on a country, you don't go in 2 days prior and, tip your hand, so what we did is we just got in these two armored Humvees and drove up the front of the battle. And as soon as we were engaged, the enemy would jump out and run on the highest roof or window we could get up to, exposing ourselves. So we weren't very stealthy. We were giving away all of our – everybody knew where we were. There was no secret. We were just trying to get up there so we could take out targets.
Mm-hmm. But is urban warfare more a part – well, obviously in Baghdad and Basra and Fallujah and all these other places, it's more a part of it. Was that a different kind of – work than you had trained for?
No, we were actually extremely comfortable in urban warfare. We had done a war lab even prior to 9/11. We had been practicing on that extensively.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously after 9/11, we were really hammered it down. We'd done numerous operations. The thing is, it's the maneuver warfare that's, going from Basra to Baghdad. Once you stop and get in a fight, it's easy. Then we can use tactics, but it's keeping up with it. Not being left behind. So we had to give away our stealth and our silence to be able to be used. And that was something that was a give and take. Sit in the back, don't get used, or, expose ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But we had all these guys around us to protect us, too. It wasn't like we were going to get overrun. It wasn't like it was just two-man guys out in front of everybody. And we had the rest of the battalion there. So basically, we just waved a flag, said, here we are, take your best shot. We'll take you, let's see who's better.
Yeah. And we know that you are. You mentioned 9/11. The other thing that occurred to me as I'm reading your book this morning is this. Why weren't you sent in to get Osama bin Laden? You can get him from 2,000 yards away. Why don't we have guys, you or guys like you, going into those mountains and, doing a stealth job and taking off this 6'6" dialysis patient?
There is. There's people out there right now looking for him. But looking and finding is two different things. That's the old needle in a haystack.
Mm.
Eventually we'll find him.
Mm-hmm.
It's just got to push all those pieces of hay away. And then you pull out that needle.
Did you dream of getting that job?
I don't dream of getting any job. I would certainly not hesitate to pull the trigger on that him or anyone like him. But, I don't ask for it. If it comes my way, I'll certainly do what I'm expected to do.
Let me take another break. When we come back, Jack will talk a little bit about being one of those Marines on that day that Baghdad fell in April of 2003. The book is called Shooter. Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin of the United States Marine Corps here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Sitting here in the studio with retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin. He just got out of the Corps a month ago. Although in all the years that I've known Marines, they tell me there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. It's Semper Fi to the day you die, right?
Yep, hurrah.
He's got a book called Shooter, which is a story of his experiences serving in the first Gulf War and now the war on Iraq. He was part of the crew that got into Baghdad on that famous day, April 9th, I believe it was, 2003, the day the statue of Saddam was pulled down. Tell me about your ride into Baghdad before we get to that particular day. Like I said before, you're a guy who grew up in the suburbs of Boston. You live now in California. I don't think you ever imagined, ooh, someday I'll be in Baghdad, especially under those circumstances. So fill me in on what that was like.
As far as Baghdad's concerned, yeah, we were hoping to get there once we were assigned the mission to go into Iraq, but I didn't think any of us thought we'd get there as quickly as we did.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that we would plow through most of them pretty easily because we had a lot better training than they did.
Mm-hmm.
But just the sheer distance would have slowed us down, we thought.
Mm-hmm.
So about a day and a half beforehand, we had to take the last bridge into Baghdad, which is the Dalla Bridge, and That was the last big fight we ever really had to face. They fought for that tooth and nail. But by sundown, we owned the bridge and did a daylight infantry assault across it the next day. And then the day after that, we're rolling in downtown Baghdad, unopposed.
All right, before we get to downtown again, let's talk about battles that you had along the way. Because in the first Gulf War in 91, which you also served in, the impression as an American watching it on TV, the first video war like that, was, wow, these Republican Guard, they're nothing. You know, Saddam's troops, they're nothing. We're going to get them out of Kuwait. This is not going to be a problem. And, of course, it turned out pretty much that way. Now, of course, since the end of major conflict, as it was called by the president, there are lots of problems in Iraq. How hard was it for you, since you'd been there the first time, to go back and fight in that same area the second time and face this same enemy?
The difference is the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard and the regular infantry divisions, they had not the techniques and procedures to stand toe-to-toe with us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how many they outnumbered us. We just had the technology, the battle drills, and the training that just overwhelmed them very easily. So the guerrilla warfare thing is what took place. And what we're getting up now is we're not talking about Iraqis. Probably only 5 to 10% of the people we're fighting are Iraqi. The rest are foreign-trained terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we're fighting the war on terrorism there in their backyard, vice here at home.
Mm-hmm.
So it is still a little bit harder because they're hiding in the midst. They're cowards. They're not out there fighting like a military unit. They're hiding amongst the civilians.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to root them out, and we can't just drop a bomb on them and, you know, kill 15 innocent people. You know, we want to make sure that we're only killing those, the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it takes a little bit of, you know, more danger on our part, being more reserve and our use of force, and you know, we have to expose ourselves a little bit more to find out where the targets are. It's working. It's taking a little bit of time, but remember, it took a long time for Japan and Germany, so you just got to stay the course. And every day there's more Iraqis dying to wait in line to become a police officer than Americans are dying in combat. And as long as they're doing their share, you know, we here at home should be proud of the fact that they're standing side by side with us.
Mm-hmm. We've got to figure out a way to do it a little bit more efficiently, and there are problems along the way with manpower and equipment and all those sort of things. But anybody who's saying, just pull everybody out of there, they're out of their mind. There's no doubt about that. No argument as far as I'm concerned. Let's go back to April 9th, 2003. Tell me the story of being there when the Saddam statue gets pulled down. Were you one of the guys pulling it down?
Actually, I was the first one into the square that day. We had got word that some of the reporters in the hotel, the Palestine hotel, were being held captive and were going to be executed. We had embedded reporters that said they just got off the sat phones with them, and that's what the case was. So we were given orders from higher to go defend those people.
Mm-hmm.
As a scouting mission in front of the battalion, I came around the corner right there in Freedia Square. And as I started coming around the corner in my two hardback Humvees, if you guys remember on TV, those first two vehicles, that was mine and my wingman.
Mm.
I was thinking to myself, wait a minute, there's a whole lot of people in there. I think maybe we want to bring some tanks up here because we have the tanks right behind us. So we just slowed down and let the two big Abrams go ahead of us, thinking it was going to be a full-on fight. And at that time, you know, we were deploying our troops, getting ready to take everything down. It ended up being that they were there to just thank us for being there.
Mm-hmm.
So
that was the welcoming committee you'd heard all along you'd get.
Exactly. And we'd seen it up to this point. I mean, we'd go in and you know, other towns, go in and attack it, kill the Ba'ath Party, the Republican Guard, and the Fedayeen, and come back out, and the local people would be there thanking us and waving us and giving us flowers. I mean, this was just a much larger scale. This is, you know, it was huge. I can't remember how many people were there, but it was, you know, as far as my eyes could see, and I had a pretty good view of the place.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody starts crowding around, and they want to bring the statue down, and they're trying to smash this thing with bricks and their sneakers, but they didn't have the power. So they asked us if they could use the tank retriever, a big, huge mammoth thing to pull down. It's a Hercules, we call it. And so we hooked it up and pulled it down.
Hmm.
And we ended up giving them an Iraqi flag to go ahead and fly up there. It was a Desert Storm 1 flag, too.
Now, what was the problem with the American flag? Who went up there and made that mistake?
It was some 19-year-old kid who had the best intentions and just didn't have the battlefield situation awareness that, you know, that's not the good thing to do, even though the Iraqis there were asking him to do that.
Mm.
I mean, I clearly saw that, but it's still, it's not something you want to do when you're liberating somebody.
Did you grimace when you saw that saying, this is everything we're not supposed to do?
My eyes are rolling in the back of my head, and my buddy Casey runs across, and I mean, as I'm looking at him, like, oh my God, he took action and ran and grabbed the flag out of the other vehicle and started to run to bring it up so he could fly that. Before he could get two steps, the Iraqis grabbed it and they realized, oh my God, this is a pre-Gulf War one, which is their old flag, and they were really proud of that. So they ran and put that thing up at lightning speed.
Your buddy had one of those?
Yeah.
Did he just happen to have that with him?
We took it in a Basra.
Oh.
So that's not like we borrowed it. We took it from one of the Ba'ath Party headquarters.
Okay.
It was actually in the back room. It wasn't being flown.
After the statue comes down, is it safe?
Relatively safe. I mean, as safe as any country that just was conquered. You know, their capital was just taken over, and there's chaos going on. There's looting going on. And this time, we don't know the fight's over. You know, we think that we're going up to Tikrit, and there's, you know, tens more thousands of troops to be taken out,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, time tells us that wasn't the case. But, you know, we're still preparing for that. We don't know that. So we're defending the positions we have, and then we're spreading out along the city to section it off and try to put as many people on the ground as we could, but what we had there to, you know, try to assess the situation.
But there were no enemy soldiers that you had to worry about right there in that square that day.
No, right there in that square that day there was. And we still had some, we still took casualties after that day, and we still had some engagements with them, mm-hmm. inside the city, but majority of the major fighting was done then.
You almost killed a reporter, though.
Well, yeah, that was right when we first went into the square. He was up on the roof of the Palestine Hotel, and his laptop screen must have been flashing right at me, and I, you know, looked like another scope. So I put my scope on that and realized, all right, it's just a reporter, so I wouldn't waste a round.
On behalf of the media, I thank you. What was your relationship with the media, with all these embeds who were there? Lots of reporters went along. Did you get to know any of these people?
I actually got to know all of them that were embedded, because we had them all in Kuwait, and I was very integral in their training. And also taking care of them, housing them, and feeding them prior to the war and during the war. So I became friends with all of them. Still talk to a lot of them today. John Koopman I talk to all the time. Gary Knight, some of the pictures in the book are from Gary. He's mm-hmm. one of the photographers, and he didn't charge me a nickel.
Nice.
I mean, that's friendship, because we all know in the business that that's a couple of $1,000 he could have gotten easy.
Now, speaking of going into Baghdad, we remember there was this weapons of mass destruction thing. And you guys, I'm sure we're told, you're going into a hot zone. You know, we as Americans watching it on TV, we're told, you know, we don't know what Saddam's got and what he's going to use. And he could have some sort of chemical thing that he's going to use. And our troops have to be prepared for that. Were you prepared for that?
Yes, we were. We wore our mop suits. We were all ready to go. Other than the shoes, I didn't put those things on because it was too cumbersome for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took my chances. I was wrong. I should have, but, you know. Luckily, I was right mm-hmm. in the end. We actually got some information that this one unit was ordered to use chemical weapons on us, our specific unit. Mm-hmm. We caught a radio transmission, but obviously they didn't have the capabilities. But somebody thought they did because they ordered them to do it to us.
When you found out later that there were no weapons of mass destruction and you hadn't been in a hot zone other than traditional ammunition possibly coming at you and not possibly actually coming at you, but that there was no chemical, biological weapons, was that relief or were you mad?
Oh, it was relief. The only mad thing was that I was mad that I had to wear that darn chem suit. It's hot as heck over there.
And yeah.
That's a charcoal laid outfit. I didn't feel cheated. You know, I've been asked this question a few times. I didn't go over there to find weapons of mass destruction, and none of us did. We went over there to help liberate a country and take the war to terrorism on their turf. If we found weapons, that was great. If they were there, then obviously we could prevent them from being in the wrong people's hands. But I still don't think it cheapens what we did. And I don't feel cheated for the fact that they weren't there.
Back with the Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin in just a moment here. It's the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. Talking with Jack Coughlin, United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, retired as of a month ago. Have you fired a gun since you got out of the Corps?
No, I actually haven't fired a weapon since I left Iraq.
And when was that?
June, two years ago.
Mm-hmm. Will you ever fire a gun again, do you think?
Not unless I have to pick up arms and defend our country again. I will never recreationally fire.
What are you doing now that you're in the private sector, as we say?
I enjoy spending time with my two kids. I have an 11-year-old and 7-year-old daughter, and just doing the daddy things, play golf. That takes up my frustration of my life. I got enough frustration with my golf game. do a lot of surfing and hit the beach a lot.
Are you being taken care of by the government as a guy who got out after 21 years in the Corps?
I have my pension. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Good. Because one of the things that we talk about is everybody says, support the troops, support the troops, support the troops. Unfortunately, when you guys aren't at war and you come back home and we're at peace or you're out of the military, a lot of that falls apart. And it's nice to know that you're being taken care of. And I hope nothing bad ever happens to you, that you have to go through a VA hospital or anything there, because we're not doing as much as we should for the men and women who, A, wear the uniform, and B, wore the uniform. So I hope that works out for you. Who's going to play you in the movie? I got to tell you, I'm looking at Jack right here. He's got this California blonde hair. He's tan. He's thin. He's in great shape, as you'd expect the guy who'd served 21 years in the Corps to be. You could play yourself in the movie, but who's going to be you?
Colin Farrell.
That's good casting.
Yeah.
He'd be good as you. You were never shot, right?
No.
You fired off all those shots all those years and never took one, which is good news. Did you ever practice on video games?
We have simulators now later on in my career. I wasn't the video age type guy, so I really didn't utilize that as a training tool. But the simulators are a great training tool now for the video age kid growing up.
Mm-hmm. Will your kids be able? Do you have any objection to them picking up one of those things and playing some violent, head busting video game?
I have objections to my kids doing anything but going to school and staying in school and living a normaler life than I did. Having said that, if they need to defend their countries, their butts will be out their door doing it. But yep. I'd rather them go the other route first, academia.
You write in the book, Shooter, that there were guys who were with you as you were going into Iraq who were worried that the Marines weren't going to get enough action, that the Army might get there first. Is there a huge rivalry between the Corps and the regular Army?
Well, yeah, there is a rivalry, but it's a lot different than it used to be, because now we're all about jointness. And I'm not just saying that to be politically correct. We actually believe that. But it felt like the Marine Corps and the orders and the plans were just going to be the diversionary force. I, on the other hand, understood the fact that there was a huge target and it was a huge responsibility. There'd be enough for everybody, so I wasn't too concerned about it. Matter of fact, I predicted earlier in the book that, hey, we're going to hit Baghdad first. Trust me. And
yeah,
we did.
But so there were some guys who really wanted to see action. You said before that while you were happy to do the job you were told to do, you never really wanted more action. Was that the case for most Marines?
For those who hadn't been in combat, no. They wanted to see it because they've been training. It's like being on a football team. You practice every day, and you never get to play on Sunday.
Mm.
Now, when you get in the field, on the football field, and you get your knees torn up and everything, maybe you're not so anxious to get back there.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys that had been in combat understood what it was, and we're ready for it, but we weren't begging for it. We knew it would come to us. The other guys who hadn't seen it, they just were, obviously anxious. As soon as they had their first baptism of fire, their attitudes changed. They were still professionals and did their job. They just actually were better. They were more settled down.
For all the years that you did it, every time you sat there in your preferred position and took out your gun and didn't take it out, it was already out. You know what I mean? You got ready for taking somebody out. Does it slow down? Does everything else go away?
Yeah, it sounds kind of corny, but everything is, for me at least, in slow motion. It really slows down to where I have a really narrow view. I only can see what's going on in front of me, and details are just really sharp and vivid. And then once it's done, it's like you finish pushing the pause on the VCR, and now it's back at regular speed again.
Mm.
So it's, you know, people describe it different ways. I can only speak for myself.
What's the longest you ever sat there looking through your scope, waiting before you pulled that trigger?
Hours. I mean, I've been in positions for days, and we turn off on the scope after a while because your eye will just burn out if you keep it. So days, I've been in there for in excess of 36 hours.
Waiting for one particular target to emerge?
Yeah, that time was just anybody. It wasn't a specific one. It was just, please, anybody come here so we can leave.
From your experience, we were talking before about the mission in Iraq and all that, and you're dealing with the Iraqis while you were there. You've been home 2 years now. What do you think of this notion of democracy in Iraq? Because you talked before about fighting the terrorists over there, but what do you think of this notion of democracy there?
It'll work. I think every day they get a little closer. There's a lot of religious, you know, difference there, but there is in our country too.
Mm-hmm.
And we just take some time so the indifferences go away. I firmly believe that if given the opportunity, that'll be a free democratic society. Now, am I saying in the next 2-3 years? No. It's probably going to take 10, 15, 20 years to get things right. But I think it'll be a safe place in the next 2 or 3 years.
I hope so. And I hope your colleagues in the Corps and in the regular Army and the U.S. Air Force and all the rest get to come home soon and safely like you did. Here's a guy who spent 21 years in the Corps, became the top-ranked sniper in the United States Marine Corps, and never took a bullet. Took some shrapnel, but never took a bullet. And thank you so much for your service and your time today.
Thank you.
The book is called Shooter, the autobiography of the top-ranked Marine sniper, Gunnery Sergeant Jack Coughlin, USMC retired, here on the Paul Harris Show. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX.